wish I was a mole in the ground. If I was a mole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down. And I wish I was a mole in the ground.
Good morning. You are tuned to KBOO Portland, your community radio still on the air in the time of coronavirus. This is the Old Mole Variety Hour, your source for news, reviews, and interviews from a socialist, feminist, anti-racist, and anti-colonial perspective. I am Patricia Kohlberg, your host for the hour. The moles dig deep for the truth beneath the mountain of deceptions, obfuscations, and downright lies told to us by governing elites to make us think that the status quo is something natural, inevitable, and enduring. It is not. We have it within our power to remake our world into one of equality, justice, and joy. If you like what you hear today and you have the resources, please consider a donation to KBOO to help carry the station through this difficult time. Today's show is dedicated to the memory of Larry Kramer, the founder of ACT UP, the outrageously militant organization that shamed the federal government into taking action against HIV disease back in the 1980s. Larry Kramer died on May 27 from pneumonia at age 84. Before he died, he compared today's federal inaction on COVID-19 to its earlier negligence in the face of an HIV epidemic because, in the eyes of the powers that be, African American, Latinx, and Indigenous citizens, much like LGBTQ citizens, are disposable. Rest in peace, Larry, and thank you. That not everyone's life counts in this country is a point amplified in all of our segments this morning. Jan Hocken interviews Mari Alin Clare from Community Advocates for Tenants and an organizer with the Portland Metro Poor People's Campaign about housing in Portland during the pandemic. Following that, Movie Moles Denise Morris and Victoria Sacedo review the 2013 apocalyptic zombie movie World War Z and the book it was based on, for their prescient take on worldwide pandemics. First up on the show today, Bill Resnick speaks with Yeva Nersissian, a progressive economist, in part two of a two-part interview on the COVID crisis. In the first part, they discuss the way the Trump regime has dealt with the economics of the crisis by giving major corporations and finance great gobs of money, but sending crumbs to the people. In part two today, they discuss the coming economy, very likely featuring considerable unemployment, evictions, homelessness, and families losing health insurance. They discuss the public programs necessary to support working people and the popular movements that will be necessary to force government action. Here's Bill.
Hello, Yeva Nersissian. Welcome to KBOO.
Hi, Bill. Glad to be back.
Yeva Nersissian got her college degree from the Yerevan State University of Armenia, studied economics, applied to the U.S. State Department for a scholarship for advanced study, and was accepted and sent to the University of Missouri. She did well, stayed to get a Ph.D., written a lot, began to work at Franklin and Marshall. She's recently been studying writing on the federal multi-trillion-dollar relief programs as the pandemic shut down the economy. She and many others have found that the federal government is continuing their 50-year trend of subsidizing big business, the banks, fossil fuel industry, quote, the private sector, and their executives and main beneficiaries. Those people have done really well in the pandemic and getting federal money. But as to small business and the great majority of the people, health has been erratic, small. There's lots of precariousness and fear. As to solutions to the crisis, she called for being much more strict as to help for businesses and rich people. As for the great majority of wage earners who are not rich, she suggested we emulate the European states that also shut down their economies to deal with the virus and just made payments to ordinary people and their businesses sometime but to pay their salaries. And in the longer term, when the virus is under control, she calls for implementing the Green New Deal to build clean sun and wind powered economy, as well as have universal medical care for all, child care, basic affordable housing. So, yeah, but let's talk about why having a real safety net and having universal medical care, housing, enough food, the people will still want to work. First, though, let's speculate some about the future. What's likely to happen to the U.S. economy, and what are the political potentials going forward?
It is very difficult to tell what will happen in the economy, how long the downturn will last, how quick or not quick the recovery will be. A lot of that depends on the public health response. So very early on, my colleague Randy Ray and I, we wrote a very short piece on the response to the crisis, and we basically argued that the economic response should be sort of secondary to the public health response, which, you know, we should have ramped up our testing capabilities, worked on developing reliable antibody tests, which apparently we still don't have reliable ones. We should have increased our temporary hospital capabilities, ensuring that rural areas that don't have regular hospitals had access to health care. You know, we should have guaranteed health care for all COVID-related illnesses and so on. The public health response should have been our first line of defense, and we have not done a very good job at that. And now that we're reopening the economy, you know, the stock market today went sky high again because we are reopening the economy. It's not really clear whether the economy will actually be open, because it's not clear that people will go out to restaurants if restaurants are open, whether they will go out to stores if stores open up. None of that is guaranteed. You know, airline stocks have gone up, but again, are people going to start traveling? Are they going to risk taking a plane flight? I'm not really sure. So all of that still has to be seen. But if we don't have the testing capabilities to safely reopen, which the medical experts seem to think we don't yet, then I'm just really not sure how long this reopening is going to last and whether we have to shut the economy down again. There seems to be little appetite for that, and it is an election year, so there's lots of political considerations, but we'll have to wait and see. The other thing to think about is that the severity of the recession and how swift the recovery is going to be, as I believe I mentioned last time on your program, all depends on how much more policy actions we take. In a way, there is really no recession that is bad enough for the government not to be able to combat it. And we have the tools. It's just that we usually don't like to use those tools.
You know, the election that will be important, and the Democrats are surely going to run on, if not both sides are going to run on it, I suspect that the Democrats probably have a better traction with it on actually helping the working class, and they won't use the working class word, the middle class, mm-hmm. Everybody's middle class in this country, helping the middle class with some kinds of medical programs to reduce the enormous expenses, maybe talk about housing and the rest, and also making sure that people have income. Democrats are going to run on expanded unemployment insurance, and the Republicans may even do that themselves. Who knows? But when they get into office, I don't think they're going to do it. You know, most of those of the people who get office and the political establishment still believes that if you really spend money, you get inflation. But they're worried about that, and they're worried that you've got to really prod people and force them to work, that safety net programs lead to indolence. This is KBU Radio, 90.7 FM, Portland, Oregon, your old mobile variety hour. Note the variety is in a variety of struggles coming from below in this increasingly tumultuous period. I'm talking to Yevhen Narcissian, a progressive economist studying the government economic response to COVID, writing about what must be done. We so far discussed that the economy, as COVID fades, maybe some, maybe not, it will create great troubles for most people in their country. And there might be political potentials, that is, if movements are able to force the policymakers into doing something substantial. And if there was a sort of presidential executive apparatus that really wanted to do a Green New Deal, those things are all up in the air. You have a conservatives think, as I pointed out, and most liberals believe a couple of things. One, that you that if you have a generous safety net, like universal medical care and also dental care and pharmaceuticals paid for, and also guaranteed jobs and housing, that many, even most, will just accept the free ride and get habituated to lives of shiftlessness and indolence, laziness, drugs. What's to prevent that? Where does discipline come from? And why is that story so false?
Yeah, well, I think that's a very pessimistic view of humans, and I would say historically inaccurate view of human beings, right? Because ultimately we had to work for our survival, and it's hard to believe that the species that had to work to be able to survive is averse to working. And we see evidence of that, that people like to be productive, that people like to be useful, people volunteer, right, and help their community. So we see people doing those kinds of things. We also see European nations that have much stronger social safety nets, and people still work there, right? It's not like that Europeans sit on the couch all day and just munch off the government. I mean, they do have longer vacations and they have more leisure time, maybe shorter work weeks, like France has a 35-hour work week. So they have more time to live. And perhaps that's something we should aspire to as well. Maybe we should aspire to shorter work weeks. And perhaps we should aspire to an economy that creates the kinds of jobs that people want to do, rather than creating very bad jobs and then holding this, sticking over people's heads, the stick that they have to work to be able to get health insurance and other things like that. You know, we hold that over people's heads so that they will work. We're basically forcing them to work, right? So I don't think this argument is true that people will not work if they get better safety net. The safety net at the end of the day is the minimum, and people aspire to doing better than others. We do have that competitive edge in us, right? So, yeah, I don't buy that argument at all.
This is KB Radio, 90.7 FM, Portland, Oregon, your old mole variety hour. I'm talking to Yevhen Arsisian, a progressive economist studying the government economic response to COVID. Let's go through just a list of the kinds of jobs that would be, there probably will be some good deal of unemployment coming up in the next several years. What are the kinds of jobs that should be developed and financed in the coming economy?
Right. Well, I think the kind of jobs we can think of is just limited by our creativity and imagination. But I would say that we need to strive create green jobs. My colleague Pavlina Cherneva, who's at Bard College, she's written a lot about the job guarantee. She has a book out on the job guarantee. I think it's titled The Case for a Job Guarantee. And she has argued that we need to think of these as care jobs. So care for humans, but also care for the environment. And these also happen to be jobs with a low carbon footprint and jobs that require a lot of workers, but not as much capital and other overhead, basically. So we can think of everything from environmental cleanup to caring for the elderly, playground monitors, or even weathering homes, making homes more and offices more energy efficient. So when we think of the job guarantee, for example, we don't think of, you know, the large infrastructure projects, although when people think of government jobs, that's the first thing that comes to mind, right? Building bridges and so on. And that has to happen, but a lot of that will probably happen through unionized workers. So if you need to build more solar panels, if you need to build more wind turbines, if you need to build a new electric grid and a new public transportation, you know, infrastructure and so on, all of that, the government will be paying for it, right? But it won't be necessarily directly hiring the workers. It can rely on private sector workers, currently unionized workers, and so on. And anybody else who's left after that can then participate in the kinds of jobs that I just mentioned. But the federal government will be footing the bill for all of these jobs associated with greening the economy. And I'm not a big fan of subsidizing the private sector, you know, giving incentive to private sector firms, hoping that they will green the economy. That we've tried that before. It doesn't necessarily work. And we don't have a lot of time to get the climate change issue wrong. Now, the Green New Deal has to be comprehensive because a lot of the issues that our society faces today are interrelated, so we need to approach them comprehensively. And the comprehensive approach is also useful. And I'll give a simple example for that. If you think about Medicare for All, for instance, it will eliminate the private insurance industry, and it will also eliminate a lot of jobs associated with billing and administration of healthcare, basically. So people who work in doctor's offices to do billing, or people who work in insurance companies to do billing and all of that. So all of those jobs will disappear. If you were just instituting Medicare for All, then you would be creating all of this unemployment, because in macroeconomic terms, basically, you're withdrawing spending from the economy, so it's deflationary, so you would be creating unemployment. But if you're coupling that with greening the economy, then you will need these people, right? Because somebody will need to work in administration for the Green New Deal. So you could hire these people who are basically freed up. These are resources that are freed up from the Medicare for All, and you can hire them in, you know, greening the economy. So it is important to do it comprehensively, partly because these issues are related, but also for macroeconomic reasons, because some of these programs will be releasing resources, in other words, creating unemployment. Others will be needing more workers, so they will be creating employment. And so the two, if you can phase programs in, so the two offset each other, then you can accomplish this without much macroeconomic disturbance.
Right. One final issue. You talked about greening the economy and creating a different energy economy, but you also talked about having to have a new grid, and the employment would come from the private sector. My sense is that the private sector, and particularly the investor-owned utilities, but also the finance and the financiers of the industrial-owned utilities, that if we're relying on the private sector, we are never going to be able to deal with climate change. The big continent-spanning grids, big remote wind farms, that's basically reproducing the system that we have now. It's monopoly centralized control in every state of the electric system, with some exceptions, wonderful exceptions, like the public utilities in lots of places. But it seems to me we have to be moving much more towards, and I think this is at least the visionaries of energy, unlike the despicable Michael Moore movie, unfortunately, are moving towards local clean energy, very cheap, very reliable, because it doesn't rely on big pylons and all the rest. It's not going to be destroyed in a storm. There's the turbines and the solar panels have become far more efficient. Every county in California has enough sun and wind, as well as land, wasted land, parking lot land, rooftops, all of the rest, to have enough solar panels and wind turbines to power. And they're confederated, so they're confederated across the region. You need a regional grid, but not this going over mountains and going through farmland and the kind of interstate system that's envisioned by the energy industry. I wonder how you respond to that. The private sector is not interested in really changing the way it operates. GM is not ready to move towards transit. They will a little bit if they can make some money at it and greenwash doing it. But they want to keep their system, and the investor-owned utilities, and especially their financiers, like Goldman Sachs and all the rest of them, you know, utility finance is the backbone of the financial system. Every rich person is invested in utilities because they get, you know, 5% a year or whatever they get. It's a hefty return because it's a monopoly and they're guaranteed. It seems to me we cannot rely on the private sector to act quickly enough. They'll start going towards green energy. No. They don't like the fossil fuel companies. They have no loyalty to the buggy whip makers or the fossil fuel companies, but they want to maintain their system of control and profit. And that's in transportation. It's in agribusiness. It's in all of those people are not going to move quickly enough towards anything. You know, they can't strand assets for one reason.
Yeah, I didn't mean we need to rely on the private sector for any of this. That was I just meant that we can't rely on, unionized workers, not necessarily just the unemployed, right? So that's what I meant. So, for instance, if you need to build a bridge, you need people who know how to do it. And those people are probably already employed, right? So it's not like they're just unemployed and you just hire them away. So that's what I meant. And also, you don't want to do this program in a way that disenfranchises union workers. So you don't want the government to basically hire the unemployed workers for these programs because they can pay them less. You do want them to rely on unionized workers. So that's basically what I meant. And of course, the private enterprise operates for monetary gain. That's how it is. And the government shouldn't operate, although sometimes it does, with the same logic. The government should operate with the logic of enhancing the public purpose. So that's what we need to basically bring back into the equation. In a way, it seems to me that in the United States, we've forgotten that the government can be a force for good. And this is a lesson that we'd learned during the Great Depression and even in World War II, that the government can be a force for good. And perhaps with the COVID crisis, if it lasts long enough, will help Americans relearn that lesson. Now, I'm not very optimistic, but that's one possibility that we can see again that the government is trying to help, you know, through unemployment benefits, through helping small businesses and so on. You know, the public health response, of course, it's clear that it has to be coordinated. Otherwise, it's sort of piecemeal and it doesn't really work. The lockdowns, right? All of that has to be coordinated, although it hasn't been necessarily. But we're learning the value of the public, hopefully. And maybe that's a lesson that will carry over. I'm not very optimistic about the prospects of a Green New Deal. If we had a Bernie Sanders on the ballot in November, maybe I would have been. I would have been, not maybe. But right now I'm not. So even if Joe Biden wins, I don't think there's any chance of a Green New Deal happening. And I think the 8 years of the Obama presidency gave us a President Trump. So who knows what 4 years of a Biden presidency will give us after that, right? So in a way, it's like we're in a fork in history, and we can go left or right. I'm not very optimistic about us going to the left for now.
Yeah. Well, Yevhen Nasisyan, thanks for talking to us today. There's so many important issues that humanity faces now. We'll talk again. Have a good month of June.
Thanks for having me, Bill.
Thank you. Hi, folks. Bill Resnick again. The interview you just heard with Yevhen Nasisyan ran out of time and ended on a note of pessimism. Yes, we are in deep trouble, but there's good reason for some optimism. Joe Biden, he will try to continue on a policy of socialism for the rich and precariousness and anxiety for most, destitution for some. But Obama was also orthodox on the economy, but he and the Congress were forced to enact a stimulus with over $100 billion for clean energy development. And in the next stimulus package under Biden and maybe even Trump, we can get even more for clean local sun and wind energy. For me, this would be important. For when the people here and around the world wake up to the threat of climate change, demand action, and they see models of clean local energy and electrified transit in their neighborhood and cities, they might join us in mass movements to demand democratic and sustainable local public energy projects and win them. Optimism of the Will and Intellect, brought to you on KABU Radio. Another better world is possible.
There's a war going on outside we ain't safe from, and I hope it don't stay long. No. Came from a bat and a snake done. Mm-hmm. Coronavirus is a pagan. Just. Gotta stay safe, cause I ain't dumb. Mm-hmm. Got the lights on with me, I got my spray on. Can't leave your house for your day job, and some people now are getting laid off.
That was a short music clip from Lady Leisha, entitled Quarantine Speech. Before that, Bill Resnick concluded his two-part interview with the progressive economist, Yevhen Nasisyan, on the economy and the pandemic. Now we turn to Jan Hocken, who speaks with housing activist Marie-Hélène Claire, a long-term organizer with Community Advocates for Tenants and the Portland Metro Poor People's Campaign. They discuss the worsening situation for local renters and the homeless as the public health and economic crises deepen.
Welcome to KABU, Marie-Hélène Claire. Good to have you with us today.
Hi, Jan. It's good to be here.
Well, you are a member of the Southeast Portland Renters in Action, and you've been working on housing and tenants' rights for decades now. You have a lot to say about the current crisis we're in that I'd like to have you speak to today, on disparities in access to housing, among other engines of inequality in this country, have certainly intensified during the pandemic. An Oregonian article on May 17th describes encampments in downtown Portland with people leaving garbage everywhere and taking over the streets and businesses worried about the reopening. Yet people on the streets struggle to survive as they no longer have access to many of the places they've relied on for their own vital services. And renters face a new wave of potential evictions around the country. So, Marie, could you lay out a landscape for us of the different levels of the housing crisis?
Yes, this is quite a phenomenon that we have going on here. And it came upon us under a structural system for housing that pushed homeless people out decades ago, and it's just been growing. And then the renter problem came along in 2015 where rent spiked, so that added more homeless people. And these were homeless people that were housed and people who had jobs but were now homeless. And then it's continued, the housing prices just kept going up and up, and then we have the 2008 crash. So a lot of people haven't even recovered from the 2008 crash, and now here we've got the pandemic, and we weren't really prepared for this. Once the city and the state shut down, businesses, they weren't making any money, and so a lot of the business people just said, well, we're not going to be able to pay the rent. You know, and they just set that right up front, we won't be paying it. Renters realized they couldn't pay the rent if they didn't earn a paycheck, and those that were at the very bottom of the income scale, like making very low wages, like people working in fast food or working at Walmart or someplace with no benefits and having to rely on food stamps to get by. Once people start to lose their jobs or were mandated to stay home from work, well, now what are they going to do? Because a lot of them, Jan, were already paying more than 50% of their income and very low income for rent. And so they were already struggling. So now not only can they not go to work, they got to worry about their health, and they got to worry about, am I going to have a job to go back to when we do open up? And that was 3 months ago, and our state isn't fully open. And then we had the homeless people that the neighborhood folks, mostly homeowners, were already complaining about having to look out their window and see cars parked around the neighborhood, pets tied to the posts, people sleeping in their cars, or homeless camps along the freeways or on certain streets in our cities that were just lined up with homeless people. And what they were complaining about was the trash, the needles, the garbage. And, you know, I went to some of these camps and I asked folks, how many people here in your camp are drug addicts? And out of like 30 people, you would maybe get one or two. And the rest were seniors, young people, folks that had jobs or were working but just couldn't afford to live anyplace. So the whole landscape changed. And so now when we get to COVID, we're running the risk of people who were at the lower income, who were housed, their long-term renters, now they risk ending up joining the homeless because they have no way to pay for rent. The rent bill is piling up even under the moratorium, which I'm really grateful that Oregon granted one.
And that includes a restriction on evictions, correct?
Yeah, so that they wouldn't automatically be evicted, but and it kind of put a backstop on landlords where it went down and filed for evictions for folks prior to the moratorium. And then I think later on, about 3 weeks to a month into it, the legal department went and refiled and said you couldn't push your claim through even though you filed it before the moratorium. So they put a stop on all of it. And they also added where landlords couldn't force renters into a payment plan. So they took that off the books because landlords were sending out letters to renters that said, either sign this payment plan, you know, if you can't pay, or we're going to, you know, give you a 72-hour notice. So that got delayed. But the problem is the bill is still adding up. And renters don't know if they're going to have a job to go back to. And
so you're saying deferring or delaying payments not really address the crisis. It kind of gives people a little breathing room. But if you can't come up for air financially, that breathing room doesn't give you much.
Because the rule is they'll get 6 months to pay back the back rent, right? But the problem is, you'd have to have a way to do that, like a job. And what's happening, because the businesses are being impacted by this shutdown, people are afraid to go out to the business because, like, for example, restaurants, you got to move them 6 feet apart. And now I understand some jurisdictions are asking that you put some partition between people. So people are very nervous and concerned about their health. I mean, we've had thousands and thousands of people lose their lives. And so you've got the health risk, you've got the job situation, and that's really shaky. And you've got businesses that are going out of business because they were small businesses and they couldn't get a business loan even under the Federal CARES Act, where you could apply for the banks to get forbearance and then get a loan. But you had to meet a certain requirement. And actually the banks, after they got those billions of dollars, they tightened up the credit qualifications. You know, you had to have even a higher credit rating than before.
This is Jan Hawken talking this morning with Marie-Aline Claire with Southeast Portland's Renters in Action. Marie, I wanted to also have you talk some about how renters and activists in the housing community are addressing this pandemic, and particularly this issue you raise of the paranoia that people inevitably feel toward one another, having to keep distant and for medically necessary reasons. How does a pandemic affect organizing and some of the mutual aid work that has been very impressive during this pandemic among many community groups?
We're having to talk to each other and organize on Zoom. Zoom's making a lot of money from this. But it's a lot harder. It's actually health risk, spending hours and hours getting radiation from our screens, and that's impacted me. It's impacted my eyes. My vision is getting worse and worse. But it takes a lot of resources. Like, you have to have technology. You've got to have computers. You have to be able to pay for internet service, right? And a lot of people who are, for example, applying for jobs or trying to get services in the city, you have to know how to use technology. Not only do you need to have the resources, and this is really impacting people like seniors and maybe families that their computer, their old one blew up and they couldn't replace it. And so under COVID, sitting there with no job and the rent payment piling up and having very little money for food, that money's going to go to just try to cover food and maybe a little health care, and if they can afford to keep paying for their health care.
Libraries and community centers have been places where people have been able to access computers, charge their phones, and you're saying that digital divide has widened in the course of this pandemic.
Exactly. And especially homeless people, they don't have anywhere they can plug in. In fact, the Poor People's Campaign representatives here, they're having to take water over to the camp because the city didn't really provide the water. I understand there's a bucket and a spigot, but we have to get volunteers to go over and fill up the buckets with water. I think they're 5-gallon buckets. And they don't have anywhere really to wash up, clean up, go to the bathroom. Didn't put a lot of porta potties out. It's very insufficient what the city has provided. It's shameful.
And the Poor People's Campaign, the Portland Metro Poor People's Campaign, is part of a national organization that is addressing this and so many other issues related to the spectacle of poverty that people might want to turn away from, but is the kind of the ugly face of this kind of capitalism we live under.
Exactly. Yeah, and they're looking at it from a moral standpoint, that culturally, where we put profits over the lives of people. In fact, we're risking people's lives just pushing to open up the country. And as we're finding in certain areas of the country, like the South, there's repercussions from opening up too soon. The numbers of affected people are growing rapidly every day. So this is one thing I'm very happy about Oregon, about being very, very cautious and being very, very methodical about both the closing and the systematically opening up different areas. And I understand Multnomah County is going to be the last one to open. I think we have to weigh, is our life more important or is our economy more important? In the era where the feds are just printing up more money, our federal officials could just sit down, let's do a reset on everybody. But to, I think, make poor people suffer, the homeless people out there by themselves, basically, you know, sleeping in the street. So what if they're blocking the sidewalk, right? This is a shame that we allowed this to go on like this in the first place. Other people, you know, are sleeping in their homes. Right? They've got a bed to sleep in. They're undercover. Well, what about our brothers and sisters that are sleeping outdoors? Those were our children, our parents, our grandparents, our sisters and brothers, our personal sisters and brothers sleeping out there. Would we be calling the police and saying, well, we don't want to look at the garbage. We don't want to look at the horror that our society has produced. Would we then rather be saying, how can we help? What can we do? That I think that's what we need to be clamoring around.
And before we close, Marie, I know you've also been involved in the Portland Metro Poor People's Campaign. Actually, that's where I met you on a Zoom session recently and was so impressed with the work you and others are doing, and both as activists and in organizing and encouraging mutual aid and providing for people at different levels of vulnerability, which is kind of obscured in this idea of opening up of the city. Well, the city is already open and people are living. And so what kind of next phase of opening are we talking about is always the question. How can listeners support tenants organizing or get involved with the Portland Metro Poor People's Campaign? In closing, could you let listeners know where they can find out more about your work?
Okay. Well, they can contact the Poor People's Campaign online, poorpeoplescampaign.org. You can contact Southeast Portland Renters in Action by calling me at 503-995-0250. You can also contact the Community Alliance of Tenants. They're running a statewide tenant-led coalition. They can go to the Community Alliance of Tenants website and contact them. They can also contact me about it. We just finished up the advocacy team, which I led that team in putting together our plan of action. And there's many, many ways they can get involved. And I really encourage people to do so, to be part of the solution. And we need everybody's hand and help, no matter how small or if you have, we're home now. So a lot of people are complaining that they need something to do. So I would say now
there's plenty
time
to do.
Yes, yes.
We're open for activism.
Yes, very, very much so. Very much so.
Okay, well, thank you so much, Marie-Aline Claire, for being with us this morning and for your inspiring work over such a long period of time and your wisdom in these troubled period of the pandemic that most certainly will continue beyond the pandemic itself. So it's so critical how we respond.
Okay, thanks, Jan.
Yeah, take care and keep up the good work.
coming to the end of a long, long walk when a man crawled out of a cardboard box under the East Street Bridge, followed me onto it. I went out halfway across with that homeless shadow tagging along, so I dug for some change. Wouldn't need it anyway. He took it looking just a bit ashamed. He said, you know I haven't always been this way. I've had my moments.
That was Emerson Drive, a country artist, with his song from 2006 called Moments, about the anguish of homelessness. And prior to that, Jan Hocken speaking with housing activist Mari Alin Clare. To close our show, we have the Movie Moles, who review the 2013 apocalyptic zombie movie World War Z and the book by Max Brooks of the same name that it was based on. The one is a work of well-researched and well-written fiction which represents a serious socio-political indictment of the failures of both regular citizens and official government responses to a worldwide pandemic that throws in the zombie trope as a means to propel the story. The other is a fairly typical Hollywood blockbuster that bears almost no resemblance in pacing or storytelling to the weighty themes laced throughout the source material of the book, yet still manages to tell its own story in a jarring and semi-effective way.
Good morning. This is Denise Morris for the Old Mole Variety Hour, and I'm here with Victoria Saucedo. We're having a movie review date night, and as the pandemic has pretty much put a hold on the magic and shine of live radio, we are recording, and this is a Thursday night date night. It's not even a Friday night date
night. It's a Thursday night date night, but yeah, we're pretending it's Monday morning.
We are. Just like we're about to pretend that zombies can actually
exist, they're real.
And kill mass numbers of people just like a pandemic. And so here we are. Is this the second in a series of reviews we're doing on dystopic kinds of visions of mass depopulation?
This is following our review of Animal Farm. We're going to follow this up with other reviews, The Handmaid's Tale, Children of Men. So stay tuned, everyone.
There's no time like the present to revisit all of the most depressing and slightly hopeful films that we know and love. And that is what we're doing these days, is watching a lot of films. So why not?
And a lot of people, I think, are doing what we're doing. Not only are you watching, consuming, for lack of a better word, new films, you're maybe also revisiting some that you've seen before that have new resonance given the current pandemic. And why not? Why not look at zombies taking over the world? Or trying.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. So, Victoria, I want to kind of give you away a little bit, because if there's anything that happens in our home, it's movies. We
Correct.
Watch a lot of movies. And one of us really likes to watch movies while doing other things. So World War Z, both the book and the film, have been kind of in your favorites for a while.
Correct. And they're in my rotation.
They're
so
in your rotation, yeah. Your rotation also includes things like Iron Man.
Absolutely.
Just let's give our listeners a little taste of, where you're coming from on this.
Yeah, I have a running joke that, I've got the favorites, like many people. I'm a Marvel movies fan. Not necessarily the comics, just the movies, unfortunately. Star Trek, Star Wars. So give me a good movie, good franchise. I'm in it to win it.
If things blow up, you're there.
If things blow up, I'm there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Not a lot of horror happens in our home.
No.
Even though I'm very interested in it. We don't watch a lot of it.
We don't watch a lot of horror. I don't. If to just keep dropping more pop culture references. say American Horror Stories on the TV, I am nowhere to be found.
Now, that's up my alley. But for our purposes today, again, we were planning to talk about World War Z, the film and the book. And this is really in your zone. I've been sort of a lazy follower on this track. I've seen the film many, many times.
Sort of. I've
been present for the film many times.
While I'm watching the film many times. Yeah. And I've read the book many times.
Yeah. Yeah. That's the purpose of watching films over and over again. That way I don't have to really pay attention throughout the whole thing. I can always go back. This is the beauty of streaming.
It's the beauty of streaming. And right. Also, you know, I'm a firm believer that there's often new things to mine in any old favorite. Anything that you return to, given whatever circumstances are happening to you right then in that moment, you could mine something totally fresh out of a movie like World War Z that you might have in your rotation of favorites. But now, again, given the worldwide viral pandemic that's happening, that basically that's what is happening in both the book and the movie, why not rewatch it and take a look at really now how prescient the book is, how scary it is, how on point it is from a sociopolitical standpoint. Some people describe the book as satire. I would not call it satire. I would call it straight up criticism. Very direct, talking about how governments are ineffective, how they're willing to sacrifice the most vulnerable to save whoever they decide to save, and everyone else they leave out, literally.
Interestingly, it would raise, and since I haven't read the book, you'll have to fill us in on this, that when we talk about who's essential and not essential, for the purposes, let's say, of the book World War Z, which is an oral history, versus the film, which is was made in 2013. The book came out in 2009.
The book came out in 2006.
2006, okay. Max Brooks wrote the book and, as you said, had a much more, I think, political motivation. The film doesn't really hold up its end in that sense. It does sort of default to a lot of the kind of Hollywood conventions of having a hero and having it kind of having the story run through the star, Brad Pitt.
Correct.
And, you know,
some
exactly.
People even say that there's like the unnecessary kind of semi interest, romantic interest. The Brad Pitt character, he's married, he has children with his wife, yet he ends up paired with a female soldier who is really integral to the story in the movie, but she does not exist. This person does not exist at all in the book.
Right. There's a lot of that.
There's a lot of that.
Yeah. I mean, probably everything we watch right now, you could say, is has that composite character or taking those particular liberties around which characters can exist and can't from book to film. But as an oral history, World War Z has a greater latitude to explore the consequences, the origins, what it means, who gets left behind, who survives.
Correct. And so one of the primary differences between the book and the movie, first, the book is fashioned, it's a very direct homage to Studs Terkel's The Good War. He won a Pulitzer for that in 85, 86, I believe. And it's a very deliberate fashioning off of that. That's considered an oral history, obviously, of World War II. Max Brooks took the ideas behind a worldwide pandemic. Let's see. Let's make it zombies instead of a virus. Although Max Brooks has been quoted as saying that the impetus for the story is actually the SARS outbreak, but he fashioned it instead of a straight up viral outbreak, he fashioned it as a zombie outbreak. So in this, the book itself technically spans 20 years. The zombie war took a full decade, and this book, this oral history of the zombie war, is actually being taken 10 years, 12 years after the end of the zombie war. So the book technically spans a 20-year period. The movie spans a matter of days, weeks.
Right, yeah.
It's
they
completely different.
They saved the world really fast.
They saved the world very quickly.
Yeah.
You know,
and not even they, Brad Pitt.
Let's just get real.
Brad. Correct. Brad saves the world.
Brad saves the world.
Cheers, Brad. It is movie review date night, so
that's
cheers.
True.
So cheers to Brad. Thanks for saving the world.
But, and again, in the movie, this character is fashioned, the Brad Pitt character, but in the book, this person does not exist, who Brad Pitt portrays. Max Brooks basically fictionalizes himself as a UN kind of reporter and investigator, the commission that's following all the stats, the figures, everything that's after the war, 10 years after the fact. And supposedly with these notes, he turns this into this oral history. So again, the idea is that everything in the book is true, based on real people, real battles, notably the Battle of Yonkers. Shout out to that. Most people really like that part of the book, even though it's completely horrifying. For people who haven't read the book, it will bring you face to face with the concept of American exceptionalism, and it'll get you right between the eyes.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. We've talked a bit about that concept as it relates also to the film, this idea that a country, in particular the U.S., and we're seeing this unfold now, believes itself to be far and wide capable and entitled,
correct.
I think, to distill it. And that has not served us.
No, well. No. In the movie, there's this idea that America is invincible, that an American will ultimately save the day. In the book, that idea that Americans are invincible, again, is absolutely knocked sideways, and it shows the actual deep, deep flaws, the book does, that exist in American society from all aspects, from our lack of universal health care,
mm-hmm.
to lack of education. It's pretty intense. And again, the people that end up being considered essential versus expendable,
mm-hmm.
all of a sudden in this zombie-infested world, the people that can build something with their own two hands, somebody that can repair a 10-year-old dishwasher, that person is very, very highly regarded in this society. And say someone who's, a marketing consultant who doesn't really quite do things, who doesn't produce anything, who only knows how to draw up a paper.
How to build, a client base.
How to build a client base, yeah.
But if they're all wiped out by zombies, then, you know.
But this person maybe can't even fold their own laundry. They don't even wash their own laundry. They send it out. So that person is considered very, very low on the reworked world order 20 years after the fact. And that person's being retrained to work on a farm. They're learning how to build a bench, that kind of stuff, because that's the stuff that is needed in the world after the zombies.
And essentially, I think we probably would agree that the film is a short-term fix for whatever needs we might have to explore these issues in the way that have been explored through that Hollywood lens.
Correct.
And machine.
Correct.
And we can guarantee our listeners that they'll find a lot of familiar tropes.
Absolutely.
It sounds to me like the book offers a much deeper exploration and much more interest. So if folks have the patience and wherewithal to actually be reading books, which I think is a big deal right now.
It is. The movie's a good intro to scratch the surface of how do you think a government would react to a serious worldwide pandemic, which is what's happening now.
Mm-hmm.
The book will take you deeper and much more along that line of thinking than you ever thought possible.
Mm-hmm.
The book, for anyone who's curious, is a pretty gratifying read. I will warn you, it is horrifying, especially given what's happening right now.
Mm-hmm.
And watching this sort of slipshod patchwork responses worldwide.
Mm-hmm. And that seems to be part of the lure of the book as well, is that it's not U.S.-centric. I mean, essentially, World War Z, its beginnings in Philadelphia, and
correct.
Then they proceed to travel and engage with folks from other countries. But essentially, it doesn't have a global sensibility.
Not that way, because the central character is always the Brad Pitt character, and given that he's an American, that focus is squarely on the interests of Americans, so to speak. The book takes place all over. People are interviewed all over the world from what's left of Russia, which is, I think, called the Holy Russian Empire, China, Barbados, cities flung all across what's left of the United States, an astronaut that was up on the space station but now is back on Earth, Antarctica. So the book really is this global view of the survivors, whether they be ragtag survivors on the edge of some disputed territory right now, or whatever might actually be left in France, which is scary, North Korea, which is also scary. So, you know, it's very tempting to give things away in the book, but really, for people who are halfway into any kind of political talk, or for people who are into history, absolutely take a look.
Victoria Saucedo and Denise Morris, that's me. We're here sort of reviewing World War Z, the movie and the book. This has been our second in a series of dystopic endeavors. It's been a great movie review date night.
Absolutely.
Victoria, thanks for joining me.
Yeah.
That was Movie Moles Denise Morris and Victoria Saucedo discussing the apocalyptic movie World War Z and the book it came from. And that does it for our show today. I want to thank Moles Bill Resnick, Jan Hocken, Denise Morris, and Victoria Saucedo for their contributions, and our guests this morning, economist Yeva Nersissian and housing activist Mari Alin Clare. Thanks also to the hardworking staff at KBOO who are keeping us live and on the air. This is Patricia Kullberg, your host today for the Old Mole Variety Hour. If you can, please consider a donation to your community radio station, KBOO. Just go to kboo.org and click on Donate Today. Every Monday morning, the Old Mo offers commentary from the point of view of the 99% and a vision of a radically democratic world. Join us again next Monday morning at 9 a.m. for more interviews and reviews from a socialist feminist perspective. As always, you can find a downloadable podcast of today's show and its individual segments in a day or two on the KBOO website, with links to further material that might interest you. You can contact us at oldmovarietyhour@gmail.com with your questions and comments. Thanks for listening. Stay safe and stay well.